Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to today's Caffeine for the Soul. And if you'd like to learn more about the psychological and philosophical underpinnings of what we talk about in these podcasts each week, check out our new free basic course at michaelneal.org/basic course. I was inspired to create this week's podcast based on some research that a friend sent me that is sort of an umbrella research study on all the research linking depression to serotonin levels in the brain. And if you don't know, for me personally, that is a very relevant topic because I struggled with depression from the age of about 12, 13, very, very badly to the point where it turned into suicidal ideation and all sorts of other things up to the age of 19, and then fairly continually, but not so intensely, from the age of 19 to about 40. And one of the things that I remember was going to a doctor who did I can't remember what it was called, but like a sort of a brain hormone test, which could screen for levels of serotonin. And she looked at it and she said, "You should be dead." Great thing to hear from your doctor. But I said, "What do you mean?" It said, "Well, your serotonin is so low that you shouldn't be able to function." And while I was a bit low energy at the time, I certainly was very functional. And I always found that quite curious. And then what was really interesting reading all this umbrella research was that there is no solid research showing a connection with our serotonin levels and depression, even though that is far and away the most common theory of depression that I've come across in the world today. And then I was struck by the fact that more than 10 years ago, I wrote a book called Feel Happy Now. And I wrote it before I had my sort of insight into the nature of well-being. So I don't really stand behind the book or recommend the book to people now because it's sort of, hey, given that you're broken, here's how to not feel so bad about it. But I remembered that the foreword by a woman named Candace Pert, who if you are unfamiliar with her work, Dr. Pert was the person whose research led to the discovery of endorphins. And she kind of became a bit famous, as famous as a scientist is ever probably going to become unless they, you know, invent, you know, I don't know, the next amazing scientific breakthrough, for her appearance in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know. And she wrote the foreword to my book. And I went back recently after reading that research, and I was kind of surprised by what's in it. So I'm going to not read you the whole foreword, but I'm going to read you bits of it. So this is from Candace B. Pert, PhD. "We're all familiar with the phenomenon of the formidable chore. It may be a closet that needs cleaning or a garage that needs emptying out. We resist it like crazy, building up a mountain of reasons why now is not the time. And our lives are too full or busy to take on even one more task. Then one day, in one moment, we feel different. And within 5 minutes, the whole job is done. It's not just about how much sugar is flowing through our muscles at any given time that determines our level of activity and interactivity with life. Our consciousness has a power and rhythm of its own. The human mind can propel the body through a chore, like organizing a closet, when it's in the right mood. And while no one would say that cleaning out a closet is a purely psychological act, the biggest hurdle to getting things done isn't in our bodies, but in our psyche. It's with the mind that we turn the flow of energy on or off in the body. Yet somehow in our culture today, drugging the brain to alter its chemistry has become unrealistically overemphasized in terms of the role it plays in controlling our moods. My background, education, and work is as a research scientist. I was originally trained in a neuropharmacology laboratory. We pioneered the development of specific receptor-active drugs that increase serotonin and went on to become a new class of highly touted antidepressants. I was there to watch rapid progress in neuroscience lead to the destigmatization of mental illness, a good thing by any stretch of the imagination. Yet believe it or not, the popular idea of a chemical imbalance hasn't been rigorously proven scientifically. Yes, blaming depression on a shortage of serotonin makes a lovely soundbite for television commercials and pharmaceutical brochures. But the conclusive evidence that antidepressants work through this mechanism isn't actually there. True, important drugs that reverse clinical depression do block the uptake of serotonin into rat brain nerve endings and test tubes. However, to cite one fly in the ointment, this uptake inhibition happens immediately, while the depression itself doesn't lift for 3 weeks. Based on recent data implicating lipid metabolism in so-called bipolar disorder, a moving target diagnosis that's been changed 3 times in my professional lifetime, I suspect that at its root, mental illness is about the rhythm of energy flow throughout the entire body. Not in a cosmic, mysterious sense, but in the amount of actual energy available for our brains and bodies to use. The idea that we can magically fix a chemical imbalance in the brain with drugs also remains scientifically unproven. And the gross overprescribing of psychoactive drugs is potentially dangerous. As the data has shown, a small percentage of both young people and adults have had severe violent reactions towards themselves and others in response to the proliferation of this kind of medication as a cure-all for life's most fundamental problems. Taking drugs has replaced working on yourself and your life. And now that anti-anxiety and antidepressant medications can be prescribed by any type of physician, the lack of counseling and sensitivity to the power of consciousness as a healing force has become endemic. Now, she goes on to say very nice things about me, but then she concludes it like this. Perhaps I can sum it up best by sharing the story of a young friend of mine whose mother suffered from a diagnosis of bipolar disorder for many years. His whole life had been affected by this, and the widespread belief that he's doomed to inherit unhappiness through his genetic makeup. In fact, there's no clear scientific evidence proving that either depression or anxiety is a genetically transmitted disease. Yes, stress, anxiety, and depression, and for that matter, life itself, can be extremely difficult to deal with. But the real burden is believing there's nothing we can do about it. Let's face it, all of us are moody. We may hide our emotions in the dark closets of our mind, forcing ourselves each morning to go to jobs that we don't enjoy and smile at colleagues we don't really know and who don't really know us. We may even resist the chore of cleaning up our thinking and our lives. And this ultimately leads us to the promise of this practical and important book. When we learn to manage our thoughts and bring love to the front of our mind, that love can override and even transform the brain chemistry fueling our bodies, actions, and lives. Now, for me, I just found it fascinating that this was the foreword to one of my books, and yet I was surprised to come across this research 14 years later, which I don't know what that tells you about me. But what was fascinating was the simplicity of her understanding. For all the sciencey-ness, what she really points to is consciousness, love, understanding can override and even transform the brain chemistry that we have. Now, it would be very easy to read this as an anti-drug and people shouldn't be on drugs. And I will tell you, while I have not personally taken antidepressants, I have actually supported loved ones and clients in doing that, and it's been helpful to them when it was helpful to them. So that's not my point. My point is that there is a possibility for any of us, regardless of what our brain chemistry says we should be like, regardless of what our current level of serotonin says our life should be like, that can be overridden by the presence of love, our awareness of our own deeper nature, and by our ability to, she uses the phrase, manage our thoughts, which was kind of more what it looked like to me when I wrote that book. But I would now say to manage the fact that we're always thinking, and that we're going to find our moods move with the quality of that thinking. But no matter how choppy our thinking might be, in any moment, we're never more than one thought away from bringing love to the front of our mind. Have fun, learn heaps, happy exploring, and I'll talk with you soon.